I want to welcome everyone to the Second Court of Appeals. I believe everyone has checked in for our 3 o'clock oral argument. Before we begin, I want to introduce the panel members. To my left is Justice Mark Pittman. To my right is Justice Elizabeth Kerr, and I'm Bonnie Sutterth. Would the clerk please call the case?
May it please the court. Good afternoon. First, let me apologize. I forgot to send any courtesy paper copies. I don't know if any of y'all prefer to read on paper, but I guess I'm accustomed to the Fifth Circuit wanting paper copies on every case, and this just fell through the cracks. So I hope y'all are all iPad readers. But this is a fascinating case because of the facts and the law here. Obviously, we have two issues before the court. One is whether Mr. Maslach should have been adjudicated at all based on that amendment to his probation conditions about 10 days before the hearing on the petition to proceed to adjudication. The second issue then is whether the trial court abused its discretion by adjudicating him based on a lack of evidence, i.e. the evidence not rising to a preponderance level. I think, honestly, the first argument is more interesting because of the law and the procedure, the procedural posture it comes to this court in. If I were this court, I think I would probably have two concerns before I granted Mr. Maslach relief there. One is simply that the law from Rogers that ultimately became dicta in Rogers 3 is, I think, still dicta in Tapia. And then secondly, there was no objection. The court would have to get to it, I think, by fundamental error. Now, that said, I think that language from Rogers that appears again in Tapia is dicta that's desperately trying to become a holding. It seems that the Court of Criminal Appeals is serious about the notion that if you've been put back on probation, you cannot then have that taken away from you for things that happened prior to being reinstated. Tapia is factually different than Rogers and different than this case because there was a question of whether certain allegations were initially considered, and they were not, and the court ultimately said, well, they could be revived on the second go-round. We don't have such a problem here.
Well, but doesn't the sequence of events really mean something in all these cases?
Well, it really does, yes. And when what happens is key. And that really segues into the second aspect of this case that I think would trouble me were I in y'all's seats. There was no objection. But there was also no indication that Mr. Maslach's trial counsel had any knowledge that this had occurred. When you go through and you read the record, it's one of those things that for me, I got about three pages past it and said, wait a minute, what'd they just do? They just amended his probation conditions with a live petition to adjudicate pending, and there's no indication that there was a hearing. And so you go back to it, and in fact, there wasn't. The amendment clearly amends his probation conditions. It's signed by Mr. Maslach. It's signed by the court, signed by the probation officer. But it's not signed by his lawyer. There's no indication that there was a hearing set. There's no minute or proceeding entry for any kind of hearing set or held on it. And so it happens in a vacuum. And, the state...
So it's your position that his counsel absolutely had a right to be informed about this?
Well, yes, and Mr. Maslach had the right, perhaps this is more important, Mr. Maslach had the right to effective assistance of counsel there. The distinction between federal law and Texas law here is that Texas adds to the various, I guess, five Gagnon factors, right to counsel. On a federal probation revocation, you don't have that, although often you get it. Here, Texas says you have the right to effective assistance of counsel on your probation revocation hearing. And that's what makes this different, because the motion to adjudicate, or petition to proceed to adjudication, has been filed. His lawyer has appeared in the case, has had a bond set. They have a hearing coming up on that. So this is not a garden variety amend the probation conditions. This is a live petition to proceed to adjudicate adjudication, and Mr. Maslach is actively represented by counsel. And so it appears that the trial court's action effectively deprived Mr. Maslach of his right to effective assistance of counsel. And I think that is how you can get to the fundamental error issue, is because he has been deprived of that right. So those are, I think, the key points to the first argument. I have some thoughts certainly on the second argument that we made, but before I head off, if the court has any more questions there, I'd certainly like to answer them. The second argument, obviously, that we make is that the trial court should not have adjudicated Mr. Maslach guilty because the evidence produced simply did not rise to the level of a preponderance of the evidence. That's necessary for Mr. Maslach to get his due process rights there.
The state argues that you're focusing on the wrong condition and that there was actually a condition that it would not be in the house.
Yes, and I have to say Mr. Wade did identify that. It was, I believe, paragraph 1C on that petition to proceed to adjudication. That
whether he possessed it among his things or not, there was certainly sufficient evidence that it was in the house. Was there not?
Well, it was clearly in the house. Mm-hmm. Did he know it was there? And that, I think, is what may be the problem there. That condition in question said that he had to have the blocking software on any computer in his residence. But when you look at the balance of the record here, that computer was found upstairs in his brother's room. The brother's room was typically locked, although it was not on this case. Mr. Maslach did not go upstairs. He remained downstairs. When the computer was searched forensically, I believe the record reflects that the account or user ID on it was in his brother Greg's name. And so, you know, it kind of falls into that same category as the bottle of liquor and the pistol. Did he even know it was there? And so
But if you know what the terms of your deferred adjudication / probation are, I mean, you would surely take some sort of affirmative steps to make absolutely sure that there's nothing in your residence that's going to get you in trouble.
Well, one would think so, but that would be contrary to what he did to try and stay in his own safe place. And if his brother, who had designated that as kind of his area, if his brother had any contraband or anything that he shouldn't have, then that would have forced Mr. Maslach to go be in the presence of that bottle of liquor, that pistol, whatever. It's difficult, I think, to really have a lot of confidence on that, because even under a preponderance of the evidence standard, this is still very questionable that he knew it was there.
Well, if we went down that line, though, you could just say, well, I never used that bathroom or I never used that closet, and you could start parceling out this home that's not supposed to have these forbidden items. And whether a bedroom door has a lock on it or not, it wasn't locked on the day they searched it.
No, that's certainly true.
So are we supposed to start finding that it can't rise to the level of proof of a condition of probation just because one portion of the home, when the entire home is encompassed in the condition, is a closet that someone doesn't access, or it's in the attic or something like that?
Well, I mean, at some point it becomes absurd. Certainly it does. The difference here is the record reflects a real effort by Mr. Maslick and his brother.
Which almost suggests that maybe he knew there was something there that he's not supposed to. That you could almost suggest, it would almost prove the opposite, that the fact that they went to such extraordinary efforts to segregate that might so show some knowledge on his part that there is something in that portion of the house that is forbidden.
That's true, but does that rise to the level of a preponderance of the evidence to establish the violation, though? And that I think, is the challenge here. This is the one area where I have to admit I think it's a closer call than the others on the substance of the adjudication of the probation. But again, when you look at the entirety of what they were doing and the efforts they were making, it's difficult to, I think, to fault him to this level that you would have to be able to.
But that would be a discretionary call with the court, would it not? The court's the arbiter of the facts in this circumstance.
Well, certainly, but this court gets to review, review that and grade the paper, so to speak. Obviously, it's a tougher standard once we get up here, but the challenge is we just don't think that that's enough to get over that hurdle. I think that the other aspects of the substance of the revocation are much clearer, and simply because of the wording of the conditions of probation and the facts of this case. The possession of the alcohol and the possession of the firearm, that's much more narrow in scope. The probation conditions prohibit Mr. Maslick's doing that, not his having those in the house. And the challenge here, again, is they were in his brother's bedroom, and there's no indication of the knowledge, much less the actual possession under the law. And then paragraph 1B is similar in that it does not quite clearly track with the language of the condition. And again, it was in Brother Maslick's bedroom. So if the court has no more questions, I'll give back the balance of my time and perhaps come back in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm going to proceed in the same way that defense counsel did and address appellant's due process complaint first, and then move on to address his sufficiency complaint. With regard to appellant's due process complaint, the state's position is that appellant forfeited his complaint by not raising it at the hearing on the motion to revoke. This court, relying on the Court of Criminal Appeals decision in Rogers, has held that a complaint, that the method a court used to revoke probation violated due process, must be preserved for appellate review, and that was in Snead versus State out of this court last year. And appellant's counsel concedes, and they conceded in their brief, that he did not preserve this issue for review, and thus the court should not even reach the merits of his due process complaint.
Is it fundamental error, though?
No. The state's position is that it's not fundamental error, because what appellant is attempting to do is convert his due process complaint into a Sixth Amendment fundamental error complaint by addressing a combination, or by raising a combination of a deprivation of counsel or ineffective assistance of counsel. And frankly, neither of those are shown on the record. There's no ineffectiveness shown on the record. There's no deprivation of counsel showed on the record, and really the record tends to show that the appellant was actively represented by counsel throughout, since the inception of this case when he signed on to probation in 2013 up until this moment. And so, and Also, in appellant's brief, he does not cite any authority indicating that he has a Sixth Amendment right to counsel whenever conditions of probation are amended. And the state has also looked for authority that would indicate that and has not found any. However, even if the appellant were entitled to bring his complaint, it ultimately fails on the merits. And appellant relies on the Rogers case again to support his argument that once his conditions were amended after the state filed its petition to revoke, that served to continue him on probation or return him to probation such that there would have to be an allegation of subsequent conduct that he violated his conditions to be revoked. But this case is a lot different from Rogers, and Justice Kerr, I think this is what you were alluding to when you talked about the sequence of events, and the state's position is that that does matter, because in the Rogers case, the state filed its petition to revoke. Then the court held a hearing where it explicitly told the defendant, I'm going to continue you on probation. And then there was another hearing at which there was no other evidence shown, but the court said, you know what, I'm going to revoke your probation, actually, based on the same allegations that I considered the first time in the first hearing. And this case is different from Rogers in that at no point in the proceedings in this case did the trial court ever give the appellant any indication that he was being continued on probation. In fact, the amended conditions that are at issue explicitly say you are ordered to participate and or comply until released by the court. And that cannot be possibly interpreted to mean, hey, I'm going to continue your probation despite the fact that there's a motion to revoke pending. And simply put, there was no promise made by the trial court, explicitly or implicitly, that appellant would be revoked only after he committed a violation once his conditions were amended. And that's how it's different from Rogers. And
Would that not be the sort of situation where you would expect to find counsel present and participating and making that clear to his client?
If there were actually a hearing? Yes, I believe so. And so the state's position is that his due process rights were not violated. And moving on to the sufficiency complaint, the state's position on that issue is that the evidence was sufficient to support the trial court's adjudication of guilty. And here we're working with a lower standard than normal, preponderance of the evidence, and proof by preponderance of the evidence of any one violation is sufficient to support the entire revocation order. And looking at the allegations here, there is more than enough evidence to support the trial court's finding that appellant violated the condition alleged by the state in paragraph 1C about the blocking software. And this was the condition. Appellant was required to install and activate software capable of blocking sexually explicit material on any personal computer in his residence. And Justice Sutter, you hit on this kind of, this is a very broad condition. It's not limited to any computer that appellant owns, any computer in his possession, or any computer he has knowledge of that's in the house. It's just, if it's a computer, if it's in that house, it has to have that software.
So the defendant was supposed to be his brother's keeper as far as making sure that any computer in the house had this software on it.
Essentially so, yes.
Or if any visitor brought a computer into the house, he would have to have that same blocking software on it, even though it wouldn't be his.
That is correct, yes. And so the evidence clearly shows in this case that this condition was violated. Officer Martin testified that there was something like over 30,000 hits of pornography accessed on that computer, and the appellant's brother even testified that he had accessed a lot of pornography on that computer. And based on that evidence, the trial court certainly could have found by a preponderance of the evidence that that condition was violated. And because that finding was sufficient, it's sufficient to support the entire revocation order. The court doesn't even need to reach the other allegations in the petition. And unless the panel has any further questions, the
Thank
state
you.
Will conclude and pray that this court affirm appellant's conviction.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Davis, what authority can you point the court to that would say that the mere amending of the conditions without more is tantamount to continuing someone on releasing them back on probation?
The language in Rogers, Your Honor, I think gets us there.
You think it's broader than just the fact that the court said, I'm going to continue on you on probation, because that's absent in this fact scenario here. We don't have the court telling the defendant that.
No, we certainly don't, Your Honor. But Rogers talks about the trial judge's actions and oral instructions modifying the conditions of probation. And, you know, here we don't have an oral modification. We have a written modification to the conditions of probation. So I don't think anybody would legitimately say that an oral versus written distinction matters.
But it's what's said. And where in the written document does it release him back on probation?
Well, it doesn't. But it clearly is a modification of those conditions that is what, Rogers is contemplating. Now, the challenge is Rogers had some additional facts in terms of it almost looks like a kind of a conditional deal where the trial judge says, okay, well, I'm going to amend your conditions and we're going to put you back out there for, I think it was 90 or 120 days, and then you'll come back.
And that certainly is understandable why that would be the law, because at that point he's forgiven for anything he's done prior to that, and you move on from there. But in this case, there's no indication that the court had let go and sent him back out to be on probation. It's just that a different condition was imposed, or amended conditions were imposed. In fact, rather than kind of send you on your way, it was like, I'm going to impose more conditions.
And in all honesty with the court, this may have been an error. They might have been meaning to amend his bond conditions. But that's not what got amended. If the court had amended his bond conditions, I don't think I have this argument. But they didn't.
But we still, though, because of the posture of all this, we're still going to have to conclude that it was fundamental error because of the lack of objection.
That's correct. But again, and this goes to what State's counsel was saying, the difference here is that we have a live petition to adjudicate and active representation by counsel. I don't believe there is authority in Texas that would require counsel simply for the amendment of conditions of probation. But we're way beyond that here with this case. We're here at live petition to adjudicate plus counsel, and this happens apparently without notice to anybody. And there's no indication that the state's counsel, the district attorney's office, was involved either. All we have is that one amendment to the conditions signed by the court, the probation officer, and Mr. Maslick. But that appears to be simply in another form what happened in Rogers. And of course, the actions, I think, that the Rogers opinion refers to is the trial judge sending him back out on his way. But I think when you get right down to it, that's not what mattered. The what mattered was the intent to put him back out there, not that he did it conditionally or for a brief period of time or whatever. There was an amendment, and that affected that return. And so there he goes. So I think that you know, the distinction here and how you get to fundamental error is the very specific posture of this case. So I think that's the key distinction there. And I will sit down if the court has no more questions.
We don't. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate your argument. Your case has now been submitted, and everyone is free to go.